This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, the journal Science reported in its online edition that scientists in Pennsylvania had discovered that the embryonic stem cells of a mouse can turn themselves into egg cells. The transformation is astonishing by itself, and its implications, well, scientists have used words like flabbergasting. One of the stranger possibilities is that a man could possibly be a mother, kind of. But the discovery also promises to change the legal and ethical debate over cloning. There are religious and philosophical issues as well. If primitive embryos can be created in a petri dish, when does a group of cells become a human life, a person? Just to be clear, so far we're talking just about mice. Some scientists think these experiments will work with human cells too, but nobody is sure. Later in the program, we'll deconstruct the first formal debate of what promises to be a long presidential campaign. But first, biology and bioethics. How far away is this from happening in humans? Well, that's just the first question. What about the scientific and legal barriers? A little later, we'll turn to the ethical and societal implications. For example, how will this affect our notions of life, individuality, sex, and family? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. First of all, joining us to explain the science behind this is Rick Weiss, a science reporter at the Washington Post. He joins us from the Post studio in Washington, D.C., and welcome to Talk the Nation.
Thanks, Neil.
What exactly happened in that petri dish in Pennsylvania?
Well, what happened in the petri dish is something that usually only happens in the most complicated of environments, right inside a mouse's or perhaps a woman's ovary, which is to say that very primitive cells known as embryonic stem cells derived from the inner core of a developing embryo, a mouse embryo, as you correctly emphasize, which in the past, over more than 20 years of research with these cells, have been shown to be able to turn into any kind of cell in a mouse's body except for sperm or egg, which are very special for various reasons. For the first time, scientists were able to turn some of these cells into egg cells, which makes it possible, again, for the first time, to start thinking about creating, virtually from scratch, the key reproductive cells for making new critters.
Now, how different is this from cloning?
Well, it provides the raw material for cloning, for one thing. I mean, as you may recall, in order to make something or somebody by cloning, you need an egg. I mean, the egg is sort of the magical ingredient here because something inside eggs, some things that scientists haven't really figured out what they are yet, do the work of reprogramming the genes inside the cell of the person that you want to clone. Without an egg, you cannot clone. And up until now, the ability to clone new embryos, whether for research, whether to develop tissues for new cures or so on, has had a big bottleneck in it, which is where you're going to get all the eggs from. So one of the things this does is open up potentially a supply, an unlimited supply of new eggs made pretty much from scratch to do all kinds of cloning experiments, whether it's to make cloned babies or to make cloned tissues for transplantation into patients.
And as you know, one of the big political arguments over cloning is that women would be used essentially as egg farms and exploited in that way. This would seem to resolve that.
That's right. Now, if you needed hundreds or thousands of eggs to do the experiments or to make the treatments you want to make, really all you need is one to get the process started. And from there, you grow an embryo, and inside that embryo are hundreds of stem cells, each one of which can now be turned into an egg to sort of get a chain reaction going and get all the eggs you'd need to do any of this work.
Now, one of the curiosities about this mouse stem cell transforming itself into an egg, it was from a male.
That's right. That was one of the surprises here. It didn't matter if you were working with a male mouse embryo or a female mouse embryo. Stem cells are so primordial, are so primitive and unformed and uncommitted to what they're going to become later, it didn't matter. You could push them down this pathway to becoming egg cells. And so in some cases, what you had was male embryos producing eggs.
And if, I guess that raises at least the theoretical possibility, we're a long way from this, but if they could borrow a womb, then two men could have a baby.
That's right. And one wonders how far away it is, other than the fact that the FDA has said it has the authority to regulate such stuff. So I think we can assume that it's not going to happen quickly. But in theory, at least, assuming, you know, what happened in mice can happen in people, and many scientists told me they believe why not, it means that a man could basically start with his own skin cell, use someone else's egg. You do need that starter egg, but mix his skin cell with another egg, get an embryo growing, pull out of that embryo a bunch of stem cells, turn those into eggs, which now have his genes, and mix those with some sperm from a partner, and you've got basically a baby being formed with one man being the father and the other being the genetic mother.
Well, the complications are mind-boggling, but among the theories, obviously you said that eggs and sperm were the two specialized kinds of cells that they had trouble creating before. If they can create an egg, some scientists are projecting that they could create sperm as well.
Could be, and I guess nothing would surprise me anymore on this beat. Sperm do go down a somewhat different developmental pathway than eggs, and some scientists believe it's a somewhat more complicated or tightly regulated pathway. There are some genes that need to kick in for that cell to turn into a male sperm cell, but it's not all that different, and it seems to me, and it seemed to some scientists I spoke to, that if you can do eggs, it probably won't be that long before someone figures out a way to grow sperm.
And in which case, men could become irrelevant altogether.
That's it for us.
Let's take a question. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Dan joins us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi, guys. Just had a question. What are the genetic implications for leaving out the female contribution of, say, mitochondrial DNA signatures and other genetic markers?
Rick?
That's a good question. We don't know yet is the answer. It's true that in order for mammalian, including human embryos, to develop properly, certain molecular switches have to be flipped in the right directions. And the way that happens right now in nature is that certain of these genes are coming from the male and some are coming from the female, and they're all preset in the right combination. What we don't know yet is whether these eggs that have been produced in mice from stem cells have all their switches set in just the right way so that they'll be able to work and grow into a normal embryo and into a normal mouse. And those experiments are being done right now.
But
so
one discovery was, as I understand it, that they did start to produce estrogen.
Well, they did. These cells were producing estrogen, and in fact, they got early embryos developing out of them as well. So far, they look normal, but there are a lot more tests to be done, and you would certainly want to make sure that everything is just exactly right before you wanted to even dream about doing this in people.
Dan, thanks very much. And Rick, what about you mentioned legal barriers. There are kinds of laws passed in various jurisdictions that do restrict this kind of this experimentation, no?
Well, the FDA has said that any kind of reproductive technique in a fertility clinic, for example, that involves what the FDA calls more than minimal manipulation of the cells needs to go through them first, and they want to look at the safety and efficacy concerns before they're going to give the go-ahead to do this. So a fertility clinic presumably right now could not just go ahead and try doing this. But the fact is that if you're not trying to make a baby right away and you're just trying to do some research on this, privately funded fertility researchers could do these kinds of experiments in the lab and see if they could perhaps get some early embryos growing.
Is the use of federal funds, is that a critical issue?
That is an issue. You certainly cannot do this with federal funds right now.
Okay. Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome.
Rick Weiss is a science reporter at The Washington Post, and he joins us from the Post studio here in Washington, D.C. And now to explore or help us begin to explore the ethical and societal implications of this development is Lee Silver, a molecular biologist specializing in reproductive ethics at Princeton University. And he's with us from the university's communications office in Princeton, New Jersey. Good of you to join us.
Good afternoon, Neil.
What was your reaction when you first heard this story?
Well, the reaction is the same kind of reaction I had after Dolly. We should have realized by now that there really are no intrinsic limits to the ways in which living animal cells can be manipulated and altered. But once again, we were flabbergasted. I think what this new research tells us is that there really are no limits in the ways we can transform one cell into another. It's a question of working out the technology.
Dolly, of course, Dolly the sheep, the first cloned animal.
Yes, and this is one more time which we've jumped the hurdle of impossibility. And before Dolly was announced to the world in 1997, almost every scientist in the world thought that cloning was impossible. That was carrying out reproduction without going through sex. Now we're going to be able to, I mean, in theory, if this could be pursued, we're going to have animals able to carry out reproduction without ever becoming fully grown animals.
Oh, why would anybody want to do this?
Well, one interesting conclusion, again, this hasn't been applied to human beings yet, but if it could be applied to human beings, it means that any person of any age or sex could, in theory, become a genetic mother. So you can imagine a lot of people right now, for example, women who cannot produce their own eggs, might be able to use this technology to achieve fertility. As Rick just mentioned a few moments ago, two men could, in theory, have a baby together. But it also means that not just grown men and women, but a two-year-old boy could become a mother. I don't think that's ethical or practical, but in theory, that could happen. In theory, a tumor could become a mother. You don't even need people anymore.
Are these creations, as Rick was telling us, some of them seem to take on a lot of the characteristics of pre-embryonic forms. You start to raise questions of are they people? Are these potentially human?
Well, the alternative is to say, are embryos really deserving of our respect and dignity? I mean, what politicians and scientists have tried to do since the emergence of embryo stem cell research technology is to say that embryonic stem cells, they don't really have the potential to make every tissue in a body, so they don't deserve respect. And in fact, nobody has considered them to be as deserving of respect as some people consider the embryo to be deserving of. But now there doesn't seem to be a metaphysical difference between embryonic stem cells and embryos.
How does this change our notion of reproduction and that magic that scientists have talked about that they've never understood, that magic that happens inside the egg?
Well, unfortunately, we're going to decipher the magic. I mean, if it becomes possible, and I have no doubt that it will, to be able to turn embryonic stem cells into sperm as well, then sexual reproduction could be completely divorced from sex and people. So, and what scientists are going to do is they're going to figure out the molecules and the cell pathways involved in all of this. So, yeah, it becomes a little less magical.
let's go to Amy, who joins us on the line from Redwood City, California.
Hi, I'm a biology teacher, and I have one quick question. Did they have any way of ensuring that the eggs produced had X chromosomes? Because I was kind of, my immediate thought was if you had an egg with a Y chromosome from this male individual, you could then, and you present that with sperm from a normal male, you've got a 50% chance of ending up with a YY embryo, which I doubt would make it, I doubt that would be viable. And the ethical issues of that are kind of interesting, too.
Lee Silver?
Well, if you had an embryo which was YY, it wouldn't go anywhere at all. So it wouldn't develop. So half of the embryos from a male would have the Y chromosome and be inviable. Half would have an X chromosome and in theory could be made to develop into fetuses and children.
The question is, do we know how long a YY embryo would make it along the developmental path?
Well, actually, experiments like that were already done in mice over 10 years ago, and we know that they die off very, very quickly. So they don't go along development very much at all.
Amy, it sounds from the background as if you've done a little biological experimentation of your own.
I just got into the doctor's office, and I must leave now. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Amy. We're talking about the ethics of turning ordinary cells into eggs. What if a father could be a mother? What does this say about the meaning of life? We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can send us email as well. The email address is totn@npr.org. More of your calls after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Scientists have coaxed a mouse embryonic stem cell into a mouse egg cell. We're talking about the possible ramifications and the ethical issues if this procedure can be extended to humans. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Lee Silver, a molecular biologist specializing in reproductive ethics at Princeton University. And joining us now is Sandra Wheeler, a professor of ethics specializing in bioethics at Wesley Theological Seminary. And she joins us from her office in Washington. Good of you to be with us.
My pleasure.
Professor Silver sees possibilities, great ones, from this new development. I want to reiterate, so far we are only talking about mice. What are the possibilities you see?
Well, I think it's a good idea to reiterate that we're talking about mice. We are, I think, perhaps rather a longer scientific pathway to making this ready for prime time, as it were, than Dr. Silver perhaps suggests or perhaps believes. For one thing, this whole process, although it obviates some of the issues raised by cloning in the sense that it offers the possibility of creating an offspring that's sexually reproduced and is a genetic offspring in the ordinary sense as opposed to a delayed genetic twin like a clone, still it begins with cloning. It begins with somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. That's how you take the somatic cell from the male, fuse it with an enucleated egg, and stimulate it to become an embryo, which you then disaggregate as the source of these embryonic stem cells that you're going to culture under appropriate conditions to turn them into eggs. And then you're going to take that created egg that you've prompted to grow out of a cloned embryo and join it with sperm so that then you're going to get, in a kind of third step, a sexually reproduced offspring that's going to have, yes, a male genetic mother as well as a male genetic father. But there are reasons that no responsible scientist is ready to try human reproductive cloning at the present time, that the safety and reliability issues are so far from being resolved. Dolly, the famous sheep, was the first viable mammal offspring from 270 tries and turned out to have significant health problems, including premature aging, among other things. So this technique relies on using stem cells from a cloned human embryo, and that means we have to assume that the eggs grown from that clone will be normal in all respects and be able to contribute half the genome of a healthy infant. It's not immediately clear to me how we could be certain of that in advance so as to justify bringing such a child into being and how we'd accomplish that certainty without doing experimentation on human subjects that would be regarded as unethical. So that's the first sort of set of, can you answer the technical questions
yeah.
in humans without crossing moral barriers about what kind of research you do on human subjects.
Okay.
So it seems to me there's a little more complicated pathway to achieving that certainty.
Lee Silver, what do you think?
Well, I think we have to clearly separate technical issues from subjective issues of values. Clearly, we're not talking about doing this in human beings right now. We're saying that it's no longer impossible to think about doing this in human beings. And clearly, you'd have to work out all of the technical issues before you apply this. But once you get beyond the technical concerns, once you believe the technology could work in the process of reproduction, then it really comes down to a question of values. Some people think that it's wrong for two men to have a baby together, or it's wrong to use pre-implantation embryos in this way. But that's a theological concern. That's not a concern that everybody has.
But Dr. Silver, that's not the question I asked. The question I asked is whether we could eliminate the technological issues and be certain of the safety and reliability of this in humans without doing experiments on humans that would be deemed unethical because of their level of risk. I didn't raise the issue about whether two men should be parents. You did.
Okay, well, the question is the level of safety that we need. And we have to remember that sexual reproduction the old-fashioned way is a very unsafe process.
Very dicey business, that's right.
That's right. 4% of all babies are born with birth defects. And so that's the level of safety that you'd want any assisted reproductive technology to go to, because no technique is ever going to be completely safe.
Well, let's go get some listeners involved. Our next caller is Holly, who joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really interested in this whole subject. The more it comes up, the more I see that the future is really looming in front of us. And one thing that really concerns me, and I wanted your panelists to talk about, is if we do move on to using these techniques in human beings, it seems almost dehumanizing to remove sexual intercourse from the whole process of creating a person. And if we ever do get to the point of making a baby out of tumor cells or skin cells, what kind of effect would that have on us psychologically? Who would take the parent role, you know, if in fact we do ever get to that point? But it seems like it would totally change the way we view ourselves archetypally as parents, and also what kind of role would a parent really take on if a child is actually created out of just tumor cells? It just kind of concerns me, and I'm just curious, like, if any of your panelists have thought about...
Well, Lee Silver, it sounds like you're...
Well, yeah, there's no practical reason to use a tumor as a in this technology. I mean, the only practical uses of the technology in terms of reproduction would be to allow an infertile woman or a male couple to use the technology. But I think it's important to point out that there have been at least 1 million babies born through a process that did not involve sexual intercourse. In vitro fertilization already brings eggs and sperm together in the laboratory petri dish.
Sandra, did
you... Yes, I would agree with Dr. Silver that the only entirely unique aspect of this technology, assuming we can resolve all the technical and scientific questions without creating too many moral problems, is that it allows a new group of prospective consumers, namely, for example, same-sex couples. It would apply only to women if we can also get sperm, which is a little more complicated, but which will probably come. It allows them to do what others are already doing, which is using reproductive technology to obtain the baby they want, one that is their genetic offspring, through whatever technical means are necessary and at whatever cost they can afford. Mm-hmm. This is the next step, the logical extension of an existing approach that we really undertook 25 years ago. Now, that doesn't mean that it's unquestionable or that people are not right to raise the kind of questions the caller raises. But how do we understand parenting? Has some definitive social shift happened when we start thinking of children as things that we supply to parents to meet their desires, and where we define children of our own so decisively genetically that people go to such personal and medical and economic and legal lengths to achieve a child that is their own? It would be a very small portion of the population, of course, who has the social and the financial resources to pursue this technology. Now, a small population has access to IVF technology.
Lee, you wanted to get back in.
Yes, I think it's really important to point out that children born by in vitro fertilization who were conceived in a petri dish are no less valued by their parents than children who were conceived the old-fashioned way. Well,
it represents a shift in a social shift as we have moved into the era of reproductive technology, where we use technique and the financial and scientific resources involved to secure for couples who can't have children in other ways the children they want who are genetically related to them.
Okay. We're not using the technique.
Social shift.
Okay.
Well, it's not us. It's the individual parents who have this option.
Holly?
Yes, and the other thing I think of as I listen to your panelists is it seems like these things are coming about so quickly. As just a regular person in society, sometimes I don't know how to think about or feel about the powers that we're gaining as human beings to manipulate ourselves, manipulate tissue and living life organisms. You know, it just seems like a realm that we're just coming into in the last, like you said, 25 years ago, and it's almost happening so quickly. I'm not sure how, you know, society is going to be able to process it all and react to it and take it in as normal life.
Well, yep. You're right. It's moving very fast, and certainly neither our language nor our law has really kept up with it. It's now possible for a child to be born into the world with a genetic father, a genetic mother, a social father, a social mother, and gestational mother, and to be declared by a court to have no parents, which is pretty remarkable. Like all power, whether this capacity is good news or not depends on what we use it for. Part of the implications of this technique is that because we know a little more about how to insert intentional genetic changes into embryonic stem cells than we do into complete organisms, it does provide another and promising avenue for deliberate genetic intervention. And we can use that to remove damaging or devastating genetic defects, which cause disease and suffering and early death, or we can use it to design into our offspring the traits we've decided are socially desirable. That does change the character of what it means to be a parent and what it means to be a child and how we understand the relationship between the generations.
Holly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I wanted to get a response from a statement made by Ted Peters, a professor of theology at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. And he said, this scientific research is like a cannonball fired across the bow of Christian bioethics. Many Christian ethicists try to ground their commitments on an increasingly outdated picture of nature and how nature works. Many still operate with the assumption that babies require a mommy and a daddy, that is, an event of fertilization or conception, upon which the entire structure of protecting human rights is built. And then he talks about this changing it. Sandra Wheeler, do you read that the same way?
I'm not sure that I would agree with his assessment that Christian bioethics, which is perhaps an anomalous term to start with, but bioethics done by Christians, how about that?
Okay.
Makes anything like uniform assumptions about what the foundations of human rights are. That's an odd conjunction from my point of view. But certainly, I think Christian ethicists who have an understanding of the world as not a mere fact, but an expression of creation, an expression of divine will, have to wrestle deeply with how we understand nature, how we understand the power of fertility and the fact of disorder and disease. We've been wrestling with what ethicists call non-moral evil since people began to think about how to make sense of suffering in a good world. And this raises a whole set of questions about what the foundation that makes us human is and what relation our bodies and the naturalness of our embodied sexual reproduction has to do with being human.
Another statement from Ted Peters, and I'll get your reaction, Lee Silver. And he asks where was I? If eggs can be activated without fertilization, does God still impart an immortal soul? If so, when?
Well, I want to come back and contrast my answer with what was just said. I think the whole question of whether this technology is being used ethically or not is what are the people using it for? If people are adults are using this in a safe way to have children that they want to love, that's the basic question that should be asked here. If it's safe and they can use it to have loving children, then it doesn't matter what the technology is in my mind. That's an ethical use of the technology. And we have learned how to manipulate nature to be able to provide loving children to parents who couldn't have children before. And I think that's a good use of the technology. The babies born are no different than any other babies. And when they're born and they're put into a mother's arm, normal mothers look at the baby and give it all the love that any other mother is going to give to their baby.
We're talking about the latest developments in biology and the ethical and moral implications with Lee Silver and Sandra Wheeler. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Lily, and Lily joins us from Berkeley, California.
Hi, I just wanted to say, just because we have the technology doesn't mean that we should use it. I keep hearing the rationale for infertile women or male-male couples to be able to have children. But as a woman who might be infertile and who very much wants to have my own child, I think that we need to take a look at the children that are already here. There's how many children are dying of simple things like diarrhea or kids that don't even have parents. You know, the foster care system is overrun. There's kids dying in that system, and I just think that we need to take care of the kids that we have here. The laws have not kept up with this, and I think we're just not ready for it.
And she does raise questions, Lee Silver, about morality on another level.
Well, we don't ask fertile people to solve all of the problems of unwanted children. I don't know why we have to say that infertile couples must solve those problems. Again, it comes back to a question of values here. If people don't like the sound of this technology, if they're uncomfortable with it, nobody's going to force them to use it. But if other people want to use the technology, then I think they should be allowed as long as the technology is safe.
Lily, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm wondering who's for it, though.
I'm sorry, we lost you there for a second.
The amount of money that's going into this technology, we have teachers that are getting pink slips, but I public ends up paying for it somehow.
Well, in the United States, the public doesn't pay for this technology. There's not any federal funds for this kind of technology. It's individual couples, and it's true that not every couple in the United States can afford this. Individual couples choose to spend their money for this technology if it's important for them to have a genetically related child. We allow individual couples to send their children to private schools, to take their kids to Disney World. Those are not necessities of life. Again, the government is not paying for this. It's the individual families.
Okay, Lily, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Shelley, and Shelley's on the line from Chico, California.
Hi. My question is about the population control. Like, if could people, everybody have birth control, and that way if you have sexual intercourse, then you have no chance of making mistakes, and you could just have a baby when you actually wanted one.
So is this a way to control population, in other words?
Yeah, because we're getting so many people, all the, you know, the population's overrun, and in the future, wouldn't that be able to cut down on the population of...
Well, wouldn't that require demanding that everybody use birth control, which, of course, not everybody wants to do?
Yeah,
it has turned out to be a practical as well as a moral problem when it's been tried, for what it's worth.
Yeah, I understand that there could be a moral problem, as I was listening to other people who have ethical problems with it, but it just seems like it would be... basically a simple solution.
Well, I don't think there are any simple solutions, Shelley.
Yeah.
Well, it sounded interesting anyway. I'm enjoying listening to what's going on here. So.
I'm not sure that everybody would be willing to give up the reproduction accomplished in what Ian Wilmot, the progenitor of Dolly, called the ordinary fun way in favor of this very high-tech and very protracted intervention.
Okay.
I understand.
Thanks for the question, Shelley.
Okay, bye.
You were trying to get in, Lee?
No, I was just going to say that no matter what technology we have, the vast majority of people are always going to reproduce the old-fashioned way. That's our instinctive way of reproducing.
Well, I think we can successfully leave it there. I think we can all agree on that. Lee Silver, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Lee Silver is a molecular biologist specializing in reproductive ethics, and he joined us from Princeton University. Sandra Wheeler, we appreciate your time as well.
My pleasure.
Sandra Wheeler is a professor of ethics specializing in bioethics at Wesley Theological Seminary, and she joined us from her office in Washington, D.C. When we return, we'll dissect the Democratic presidential debate that took place over the weekend and look ahead to what might be a very long presidential campaign. 9 Democrats appeared on the stage yesterday. Did you see the debate? And if you did, what did you think? Give us a call. 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.